Tonight on Arena, Pulitzer Prize winning author Jane Smiley on her new book, The Strays of Paris, and we preview the new Netflix series, Behind Her Eyes. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Jane Smiley is the author of the Pulitzer Prize winning novel A Thousand Acres and more recently of the Last Hundred Years trilogy, comprising the books Some Luck, Early Warning and Golden Age. Her new book, The Strays of Paris, features a horse, a dog, a raven, two ducks and two rats. And it's all about the unlikely friendship the animals form with each other and indeed with an eight-year-old boy. This is a story about the cost and the reward of true friendship. And I'm delighted to have Jane Smiley join me now on the line. Jane, in the world of entertainment, we often hear the advice not to work with children and animals. Now, I don't know if that advice carries the same weight in the world of literature or not. Did you decide to ignore the advice, or what brought you into a world with a book full of animals?
Well, I love animals and I work with animals all the time. And I have a lot of children, three of my own and two of my husband's. So animals and children do not scare me.
But
I actually have to say that this book started with a horse that I own, and it just moved out and some other animals joined it and it joined the horse and it just seemed like fun, so I kept going.
You started with a horse you own, a horse called Perestroika. Do you really own a horse called Perestroika?
I do. Her sire was a horse named Moscow Ballet, whose sire was Nijinsky. And so I thought Perestroika would be a nice, peaceful name to give her. But we call her Paris, not Perestroika.
Which is exactly what the horse is called in the book. You know, normally the question, how autobiographical is this book, is batted off into play. But straight away you give me autobiography in terms of the animal ownership at any rate. But there must have been something about an animal world that essentially our two lead characters here, Jane, are a horse, Paris or Perestroika, and the dog that she meets when she kind of breaks loose. She's a racehorse, it has to be said, and quite a successful racehorse. She has a purse with her when she leaves her pen.
Well, she doesn't know what a purse is until the dog explains it to her.
No value on money at all. Often the case for those who have plenty of it. Possibly she fits into that category. But what brought you, you know, when you say you just started with the animals and you kept going for fun, the obvious comparison here is Animal Farm and the allegory that it was for in terms of Russia at the time, I suppose, or Russia and the Russian Revolution. Was there any allegory in your mind as you wrote this?
No. It was just fun. I happened to be in the Place de Trocadero. I happened to have visited an American woman who has racehorses in France, and I happened to have this filly, who at that point, I think she was about three or four, and I just was laughing, and I said, oh, it would be so much fun if a horse escaped the race course and came into Paris and explored. So no, there's no allegory. I just wanted to make it, you know, go step by step and to be fun.
And even after the event, did you begin to notice allegory within it?
Well, I noticed that the animals were learning things, and so was the boy, and so was the grandmother, and they were learning things in the way that people learn things. But it was more about, it wasn't about a larger political context. It was more about how to get along, how to help each other, how to learn to overcome your anxieties. That's especially true of Frida.
Yeah, Frida is the dog in the story.
Yes.
To what extent do you really stick, or did, as you were writing, did you stick with these characters being animals, or did they start to take on human characteristics, you know, despite all your best efforts?
Well, they can communicate, they have thoughts and feelings, but anybody who rides horses knows that horses pay attention, they have thoughts and feelings, they observe. They have idiosyncratic qualities, because if you don't notice them, they're going to buck you off. I mean, if you don't notice who they are, you're going to be surprised at some point and you're going to fall right on the ground. So you have to be constantly aware of what they're thinking, what they're feeling, and then how they're going to react. So it was only just one step from there to writing from the horse's point of view. And if I could write from a horse's point of view, and Frida was our dog too, so I could write from a horse and a dog's point of view, well, why not others?
Frida was the actual name of your dog?
Yes.
She was a rescue.
She was a rescue. And she was a lovely dog, very beautiful and sweet. But she had this look on her face that I always said was German because it looked like existential despair.
But she
had her personal qualities too, and we paid attention to them.
Yeah, was she as streetwise as Frida is in the book? Because I feel really poor Paris, who's this horse with a purse, who doesn't even know she has a purse, doesn't know what's in the purse. Frida knows there's money in the purse and knows, yep, money means food. Was your own dog Frida as streetwise as Frida in the book?
No, she was not. She was wildlife-wise, let's put it that way. You had to watch her. If you took her to the beach, you had to watch her and make sure she didn't suddenly zoom off and, you know, grab a seagull. But no, I have to say Paris did not know. I mean, Frida, bite my tongue. Frida did not know what an actual purse was.
All right,
but she was hungry. She loved to eat.
Yeah, and she knew how to. It sounds as if she knew how to do that. Now, the way you speak about your own animals, clearly, you love them, presumably.
Yes.
I'm not sure whether it's more or less than you love your husband and children, but let's put that to the one side for the time being. But
you should have asked me that when I was a kid, because what I wanted most of all in the world when I was a kid was a horse who would be my very best friend and would make up for all the other kids and everybody else. So those times have changed, but, you know.
So, in fact, as the young Jane Smiley felt that perhaps the friendship of animals was it a more valuable friendship than the friendship of humans?
Well, maybe it was more interesting and less fraught with, you know, teasing and put downs and the sorts of things that we all remember from, you know, when we were 12 or 11 years old.
Because it is one of the things that, apart from we haven't touched on Raoul, or to give him his full title, Sir Raoul Corvus Kovac, who is the raven in this particular situation. Who has a lot to say for himself, it has to be said, and uses as many words as possible any time he's given a chance to speak at all. He's quite judgmental, but the relationship certainly between Frida and Paris, you would have to say, while Frida might be a little bit streetwise in the beginning and seeing the person thinking about getting things on, it is one that seems to be about acceptance of each other and non-judgmental.
Well, yes. I mean, one of Frida's problems at the beginning is that her owner has died, and she's been very lonely. So she might not have taken up with Frida, you know, a year before, but she is interested, and she's also interested in the purse. Let's not put that past her.
No.
But she doesn't mind being attaching herself to another animal because she doesn't have anybody else.
And it's interesting, I'd have to go through the book page by page to be absolutely certain again, but as far as I'm aware, when we see the word owner near to Frida's name, it's just the word owner. But when we see the word owner, certainly on several occasions next to Paris's name, owner is in inverted commas. Is it different for horses and dogs?
Well, in this case, the trainer, the people that Paris has connections to are the trainer and the trainer's assistant. She doesn't quite know who the owner is. Sometimes the owner comes and visits her and watches her in a race, but she doesn't actually connect with her. So she doesn't understand that. But Frida understands it because she spent her whole life with this busker on the streets of Paris. And she helped him, for example, at Christmas time. Her job was to stand by the bowl where he would get the money and tremble as much as possible, as if she's freezing to death, and then people would pay more money. So she knew her job.
Yeah. Now, you see, and I know you, I know I'm lobbing this ball up in the air so that you can smash it down in front of my face. But when when I read Paris and I saw owner and I thought, all right, so Paris is working in some quite successful position where she gets very well paid but has very little value on it, doesn't even know what kind of money is in her bank account. Madeline and Delphine, the groom and the people who look after in the stable, they're her managers perhaps at work, and the owner is the big bad boss who in fact knows nothing. That's all me, is it? You didn't mean any of that.
That's all you. Yeah, that's all you.
Are you seriously telling me that you weren't aware of such an allegorical reading?
Well, I have owned a few racehorses in my time, and I knew that my job was to take good care of them and make sure they were taken good care of. So I wouldn't have put that allegorical reading on it.
You're just not going to give in on the allegorical thing at all. Even Perestroika. Now, when you named Perestroika the real horse, had it anything got to do with Glasnost and Gorbachev in Russia, in the Soviet Union, rather, in the 1980s, and society opening up in some way? Was any of that in your mind?
Oh, yeah, that was in my mind, because I felt like there was this moment of, just as you said, openness and this desire for peace. And I thought, well, since the sire's name is Moscow Ballet, I have to come up with some sort of Russian-type name, and that was the first word that came to me. And it seemed like it's not only some sort of pleasant associations, it's also a rhythmic word that I like. So that was the name I came up with.
Again, you're just telling me it was for the sound of it, nothing else. Are horses totally misunderstood? I'm reading a line here from reasonably early on. All her life, Paris had heard the humans talking about her. She's nervous. She's sensitive. She's spooky. Be careful. She can get out from under you in a second. Paris doesn't feel she's any of those things, does she?
Well, she knows that she's a complex being. And she knows that she has her own ways of thinking and doing things. But she's also young. She's still just a filly. At the beginning of the book, she's only 3. And so I wouldn't say that she has an enormous amount of self-knowledge. But it's like listening to people gossip about you. you hear what they think of you, and you relate that to what you think of yourself, and maybe sometimes you learn from it. And that's, I think, I want her to learn from what she's heard the people around her say.
I was looking back at the time you wrote 13 Ways to Look at a Novel, which is where you read 100 different novels and had a look at the ways that these specific novels spoke to you as a writer and what they did in terms of the novel itself. And that was written, I think, in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. And part of the reason you did, one of the novels you went to, I think the first one you went to was a 10th century novel, because you wanted to get away from the world that you were living in some ways at that time, get away from the bombast and or not the, the constant barrage of news items. Obviously, it had to be spoken about. I'm wondering to what extent in the animal world then, were you once again trying to get away from the world of humans? Maybe there was something going on at home that made you want to do that? Or perhaps, this was probably written well ahead of pandemic, I'm guessing.
Oh yeah, I started writing it in 2009. I was sort of writing it parallel to the Last 100 Years trilogy. So I wouldn't say that I consciously wanted to get away with the trilogy, but as I progress through the trilogy, it pretty much gets darker and darker. And so, yes, Perestroika, writing Perestroika in Paris, or as you call it, the strays of Paris, that was a pleasure and a relief from pursuing all these dark threads in the Last 100 Years trilogy. I mean, I have to say, the third book of the trilogy is called Golden Age. Mm. And I kept telling the publisher that I wanted to call it Uh-Oh.
I know.
But the publisher said no, it wasn't going to work.
Yeah, I wondered about that because Some Luck obviously deals with the early part of the 20th century and immigrants moving to America at that time. Bit of luck was needed there. Early Warning is all in around the kind of nervousness that was there in the post-war era, that we were all going to be blown up by a nuclear explosion and that would be the end of that. And I thought, Golden Age? Really? The end of the 20th century? And the beginning of the 21st century is a golden age. It is a much darker time than that. You did say, however, regarding the 10th century book, The Tale of Genji, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that no matter how hard you tried, you still found in that novel and in other novels that you read from previous periods in history, you ended up looking at contemporary society. So when you write a novel about animals, surely you don't really get away from the real world when you do that?
Well, that depends if you're in Paris or not.
You're just not going to give in on the animal thing, are you?
No, I'm not. So, but let me say, since one of my favorite places on earth is Wicklow and Glendalough and all of that area, that's a place where you can get away from all the horrors of, or at least where I can get away from all the horrors of what's going on. So.
And do you visit there regularly?
No, I have only been there once, and I want to go back, but, you know, there's always something in the way, and now it's the travel bans and stuff like that. So
yeah, you obviously
do hope to go back.
Okay, well, listen, lovely to speak with you this evening, Jane. Are the further adventures of Perestroika, are they on the way?
Well, my writing instructor and I talk about this all the time, and we always laugh, but we keep putting other little ideas into it. So who knows, but maybe.
Thanks a million, Jane, and lovely to have spoken with you this evening.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Jane Smiley, and she's been speaking to us about her book, The Strays of Paris. It's called Perestroika in Paris in the US, and it's called The Strays of Paris here in Europe. It's out now and published by Mantle. Almost 24 minutes past 7 on Monday night's Arena. Behind Her Eyes follows the story of a single mother whose world is thrown off kilter when she begins an affair with her new boss. And matters take an even stranger turn when she's drawn into an unlikely friendship with his wife, Adele. And the character of Adele is played by Eve Hewson in this new Netflix series. What starts as an unconventional love triangle soon becomes a dark psychological tale of suspense. It's based on the 2017 best-selling thriller by Sarah Pinborough. Miriam McGill has been watching Behind Her Eyes for us, and she joins me now. That basic setup, Mary, it sounds, you were in contemporary London, very well-off couple. It sounds like the setup for domestic noir in some ways. Is that where the area we're in?
Yes. Can you believe it, Sean? Another one.
Yeah.
This train has been running for a very, very long time now, since the days of Gone Girl. And, you know, it shows no signs of abating at all. But yes, we're very much in that territory here. We've got this beautiful, leafy London suburb with these fantastic houses and a gorgeous park. And, you know, one side of the park we have, you know, the kind of very middle class lifestyle. On the other side of the park, we have the high rise towers. But these kind of elements intermingle with Louise, the single mother, who's, you know, kind of the main protagonist the piece, when she runs into David at a bar, presumes he's single, learns that he's not, he's very much her new boss, which is a bit of a spanner in the works. So we've got these different kinds of domestic situations colliding, as it were. But as so often is the case in domestic noir, Sean, would you believe that there's a lot more going on beneath the surface than we initially realise?
Well, let's have a listen to the moment when Louise, as you say, who's the main protagonist in the piece, Simona Brown is the actor playing Louise in this scene. Well, in the entire series she plays the character, obviously. And the character of David is played by Tom Bateman. And this is the night they meet in the bar by accident.
So what's your excuse? Sitting here on your own.
My mate Sophie blew me up.
So you knocked my drink flying just to have someone to talk to.
Technically, I was leaving.
Fair point.
Or maybe you saw me coming and engineered this.
You got me.
Well, if that's true, then you owe me £12. Bloody McCallan. I never heard of it.
It's Scottish.
Like you. I like your accent. Anyway, I better be going.
One for the road.
Are you trying to get me drunk?
Have a water. Some crisps. Just trying to get you to stay.
Why?
I like your company.
I'm not coming back to yours.
You're very direct.
I just don't want any wrong signals.
Well, mission accomplished. So, about that drink.
And that's Tom Bateman as David and Simona Brown as Louise in a scene there from the opening episode of Behind Her Eyes, the new Netflix series that Miriam McGill is speaking to us about this evening. You got to watch The Charming Ones in a domestic war, don't you?
You sure do. And I mean, you can hear it right there in that clip. There's an instant connection there. You know, David is, he can be very charismatic. He can also be very sharp and guarded, would you believe, Sean? And yes, you have to be very careful because right from the get-go, all is not what it seems. You know, David is married. He's married to Adele, as you say, played by Eve Hewson. And Louise suddenly finds herself. She already has so much on her plate. She's a divorcee. She's a single mother. She's quite vulnerable and lonely. You know, she's very much taking care of a lot. And she, the last thing she needs is to find herself in some kind of bizarre love triangle. But that is what ultimately happens, particularly when she runs into Adele, who seems hell-bent on being her friend.
There's a lot of running into people, mind you, isn't there, in this?
Yes.
Certainly in the opening episode, now I think it actually has that title within it, in the opening episode, it talks about, you know, unusual encounters. But there's an awful lot of coincidence in that respect.
There sure is. And if you are not a fan of twists that seem a bit, you know, sharp or unrealistic, then the show is definitely not for you. If, on the other hand, you enjoy a juicy thriller and you're, you know, familiar with all the conventions and you're happy to go with them, then Behind Her Eyes just offers them up, as we even heard in that clip that you just played there. I mean, over and over and over again, we know this stuff, it's familiar territory, but it's the plotting and it's the what we don't know that makes us want to go with it. And you know, there's a lot going on, more than meets the eye, would you believe?
Yes. And the character of David, as played by Tom Bateman, he's a psychiatrist, so there are all sorts of depths that can be gone into in that particular respect. A lot of dreams and a lot of what are referred to as night terrors for several characters, in fact.
Yes. So Louise suffers terribly from night terrors, and not only night terrors, which are clearly linked to some trauma in her background, which all of the characters seem to have to some degree. Her night terrors also involve a degree of sleepwalking. And it's, as someone who lives, you know, way up in this very high apartment block, this is quite serious. At one point, you know, she finds herself suddenly awake, having collided with the wall of her balcony, and look a couple of steps more and God knows what would have happened. So Louise's night terrors are, you know, a kind of symbolic device as well, because of course, the deeper she gets involved with these strange couple of Adele and David, the more those night terrors seem to intensify, and they play, and this whole, the whole notion of a dream world and an eternal self, they play a key part, both in the kind of symbolism of the show, but also the show's many twists. And I have to be very careful about what I say about that, but they're very important.
Yes, yeah, there are several twists within it. Now, I talked to you, we in the first clip that we heard, Louise had bumped into David and knocked over his drink. Well, guess what? She bumps into his wife as well, the Adele character played by Eve Hewson, and they go off for a coffee afterwards. So let's have a listen to their early encounter.
I'm sorry. I don't think we've met.
No, we haven't. Sorry. But I work for your husband 3 days a week. Not today. Anyway, that's... I saw your picture on his desk.
You work with David? I just walked him there. Oh. I fancied a stroll this morning. Small world. I'm Adele.
Louise. Are you sure you're all right? Anyway, better be going.
Louise? I don't suppose you fancy going for a coffee?
Oh.
I mean, if you have the time.
I'm new here and I don't really know the area, so... Please? Make up for knocking me down? Sure. You lead. I'll follow.
So there you go. She has to spend, was it 12 or 15 quid for the beer that she knocked over? And she has to bring the wife out for coffee almost the next day. It is the next day, in fact, isn't it?
Because it is the next day.
But again, within that, Miriam, because that's a clip from Behind Her Eyes, and Adele, played by Eve Hewson, and Simona Brown playing the character of Louise in that clip. Again, be careful of, if it's the charming man, you also have to be careful of the, oh, I'm a little bit lost, will you look after me? You have to be careful of that character in a domestic noir as well, don't you?
Oh, you surely do. How different things would have been for Louise if she just simply said, no, I can't go for a coffee. I've just too much on my plate. But of course, we wouldn't have a drama in that case. Yes, there are depths to Adele. And this is a really interesting performance from Hewson, because she has to be a kind of an enigma. One minute, a kind of a glacial presence, a kind of detached presence. But as you heard there, also kind of warm and occasionally very, very vulnerable. And again, you know, she is someone who has quite a complicated and traumatic past. She spent time as a very young woman in a mental health facility after her parents were killed in a fire that David rescued her from, and has scarring to show for it. She's independently wealthy. Her parents were had a vast wealth that was left to her that she inherited, so she doesn't need to work. She lives in this beautiful home, but a very sterile home. So she is she's a person who's full of contrast. She could quite be legitimately lonely. Who knows? Perhaps not. But again, that's a great example of how the show sets up these various, you know, we know these codes, we've seen them play out before, but it's the directions that it goes in that kind of propels you along. It's not so derivative that you're like, oh, I don't care, I know exactly where this is going. No, it does have the power to surprise you.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Is there sufficient in it? Now, we should say anything that you've told us, we found out very quickly, because the whole scene around her time, the Eve Hewson character's time in a psychiatric hospital, that is all told in flashback quite quickly. And, you know, you're in the middle of that all very quickly during the first episode. But you're saying that it did take enough twists and turns and keep you guessing, because certainly in the first couple of episodes that I watched, you didn't really know who was the goodie and who was the baddie. You were pretty certain, at least I thought I was, that Simona Brown's character, Louise, was kind of a bit of a pawn in this game, but you weren't sure about who was the master chess player in the couple.
Yes, and I should say, people might be familiar with the 2017 novel that the series is based on. It was a bestseller. It one of the big marketing ploys around it was a huge twist towards the end. So I think I think fans of the novel will be piling in to see what they've done with that. And I think for anybody else who is a fan of domestic noir, or also, you know, just wants something, Netflix are very good at this. And they had another hit last year called The Stranger. You know, this kind of schlocky, melodramatic, again, kind of domestic noir series that was just a huge hit. People were kind of hate watching it nearly in a way. You know, Behind Her Eyes is far superior to that. But it has, you know, those conventions that just make for a really enjoyable watch. I sat down on Friday evening intending to watch an hour of it, and I, you know, surfaced three episodes later. It does drag you in, you know, in a really enjoyable way. It doesn't rewrite the rule book, you know, there's nothing necessarily groundbreaking here. But I think, you know, good performances, some really solid writing, and some, you know, interesting plays on the genre.
Yeah, well, talk to me about the performances there in particular. Lots of talk that this might be a big breakthrough moment for Eve Hewson.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that, Sean, and that's no reflection on her. I'm not sure about, you know, this as a platform. It's not necessarily a prestige drama. I'm sure lots of people will get to see it, but I think she is deserving and indeed very capable of something even, you know, bigger than this perhaps more dramatic. I could see that for her. This is, you know, a kind of a paint by numbers setup where, you know, she acquits herself really, really well. And I'm not surprised that there is speculation that this could be her breakout role, because she has been doing great work. You know, she was the star of The Luminaries, the adaptation of Eleanor Canton's novel last year, that was quite buzzy. I'm sure it's only a matter of time before she does break out. I'm just not sure that this is necessarily it. Simona Brown, I have to say, as Louise, the central protagonist, such a likable actress, carries the role. Louise needs to be likable, and she certainly gets that across, and you really feel for her. You want to look out for her, as it were, because you can sense the kind of dangers that she's heading into. And then Tom Bateman as David, David in many respects is an archetype of this particular genre, and he does a fine job of that.
Jamie Dornan, he's Jamie Dornan's Scottish cousin, really, isn't he?
Absolutely. Cut very much from the same cloth. The only thing I would say, and this isn't any reflection on him, is that his character is written a bit unevenly. So he kind of jumps one moment from being this kind of cranky Scotsman to suddenly being, you know, this kind of desperately lonely, kind of lost, searching. You heard in the bar scene that you played there, he just sounds like somebody desperately in need of a friend. So that can be quite choppy. But again, you know, this is a solid piece all round.
To what extent do you think Eve Hewson, she's Bono's daughter, to what extent do you think in this country her performances will always have that extra edge of criticism put on them, be it good or bad? You know, if you're a fan of the father, you'll possibly be a fan of the daughter, or the other way around. Do you think that's a difficult thing for her to navigate?
Oh, I'm sure it is. And I don't think it's particularly fair, you know, because young people, whatever direction they take, shouldn't have to be burdened with whatever path their parents have chosen. And I think, I mean, you look at the calibre of directors that she's worked with. I mean, Steven Soderbergh, she was in, you know, Steven Spielberg's Bridge of Spies a couple of years ago, which is a great film. I don't necessarily think that your father is going to land you roles with directors like that. I think you really need to have the goods, and clearly she does. Just as you're saying that, I'm thinking, of the idea of, you know, the kind of apparently, you know, Bono talks about the American attitude to success versus maybe other types of attitude to success, where, you know, there's a more open idea of working hard and achieving that maybe we're a bit more suspicious of in Ireland, perhaps. But no, I mean, I think who she's worked with and the projects that she's worked on say it all.
Yeah, they speak for themselves. Yeah. The series then, there is one other character I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, because he's just been introduced where I am in the series.
Oh, yes.
This is the character of Rob, played by Robert Aramayo. Is that how I say his name? Game of Thrones and Nocturnal Animals he's known from.
Yeah, so he forms a close relationship with Adele back when they are in, young people back in, when she's in this mental health facility. And they seem to be very close. He doesn't seem to be a presence in her life when we meet her in the present day. That said, he is very much there in the show in terms of flashback. And she also holds on to a copybook of his, which she then gives to Louise when Louise confides in her about her night terrors. And there's some advice, she says, in this copybook that used to belong to Rob that might help Louise. Is it all as it seems? Perhaps not.
Yeah, well, that's where you're going to have to be watching. Have you watched all of it at this point, or are you still, have you left a little bit to binge on?
I've left a little bit to binge on. I've got to exercise that impulse control. So you do, Sean, at the moment. There's a lot of bingeable stuff out there, but I'm looking forward to watching the rest of it for sure.
All right. It's a six-parter, and it will be available on Netflix from this Wednesday. That's Miriam McGill speaking to us about Behind Her Eyes. Dublin producer and songwriter David Balfe, also known as For Those I Love, will release his much-anticipated debut album next month. His latest single, Birthday, The Pain, was released last week. A track that was put together through the use of old recordings, WhatsApp messages and samples, and addresses the fallout of witnessing a violent death as a young child. Let's listen to the single now, and there is some language within this as well.
Body dumped on me road when I was six, then left on bricks. No training that week, my coach couldn't speak. Blood on his hands as the man died at his feet. And me, I stood at the scene. No sheets to block the bodies we dream. They stay evergreen. And this is no dramatics. This is no tales and 90s classics.
And that's For Those I Love with his new song, Birthday of the Pain. By the way, he was one of the interviewees on the Tommy Tiernan Show on Saturday evening, and it's well worth looking back at that interview just to get a sense of where that song comes from. It'll stop you in your tracks, certainly stop me in my tracks on Saturday evening. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. The sounds there of the strange, eerie effects that are made in the depths of compacted ice. So how do the natives of cold lands exist where frozen expanses of ice are the only landscape for most of the year? Lake Baikal in Siberia is one such place, known as the Pearl of Siberia or the Sacred Sea, and it's also the subject of a photography exhibition at the Copper House Gallery in Dublin and a new book called Beacons from photographer Dara Muldowney, who spent three stints on Lake Baikal creating this body of work and recording the sounds you just heard. And Dara Muldowney joins me now. In fact, Dara, now we'll talk about the visual aspect of it in a moment, but I believe the sounds were an absolute shock to you when you first encountered them.
Yeah, hi Sean, thanks for having me on. It was an incredible experience. I guess it was a scary experience when I first heard it. I was like, geez, am I safe here? Mm. I was wondering, was it about to collapse from under me? It was this constant sound of popping and grinding, just accompanying your every step as you walked on this frozen surface. Extraordinary experience.
Describe Lake Baikal to me.
Well, I mean, for the listeners it's, as well, it's like it's the largest freshwater lake on the planet. It's 700 kilometers from top to bottom, and in the width it reaches up to 70 kilometers. It reaches up to 1,642 meters in depth, and it has 23% of the world's supply of fresh water. Now, it's a big place.
Yeah.
It is, you know, I guess in the winter, I've only experienced it in the winter now. I'm sure it's a very different experience going there in the summer. But for me, it's all been about the cold place and places on the planet. So, I mean, I guess when you step out onto this lake, it's like this frozen lake. It becomes like an icy plain, like an expansive icy plain. I mean, it's a multi-sensory experience stepping onto it, because you know you're assaulted on all levels. One, the visuals. It's such a surreal place to have this expanse of white and blues and just like it's like being in on the sea. So you have your horizon all around, like in 360 degrees as you spin around. You've got full horizons, and you know. Sorry, go on, yeah.
How cold is it? I mean, I can't believe that you only went there in the wintertime. How cold is it in the wintertime? We're up in Siberia, so we're very far north.
Well, actually, it's the same line of latitude as we have here, but the reason why it's so cold is it's inland so far. And it's, you know, you'd think that it's... When I first went there, I was expecting to see the Northern Lights because I thought it was north as well because it was so cold. But then once I got there, I was like, oh, no, it's the same. You get the same length of daylight as you get back home. But it's inland, I guess, and it's also slightly elevated. It's at about 1,000 metres in elevation. And it's just so far inland that it gets this extreme icy cold winters. We've heard about the beast from the east over here. So it's just an extraordinary place to visit. And for me, I like the cold places. So that's one of the reasons why I went in the winter and not the summer.
Yeah, the beast from the east would originate in and around places like Lake Baikal. And when you're talking about inland, we're a little bit further inland than the Irish Midlands here. So we're talking serious cold. And as you say, that elevation is quite important in the story as well. There's a video that accompanies the exhibition, Dara. And in fact, that one of the photographs in the book, we get a picture of this. You arriving on this, you know, what looks like an enormous ice rink, effectively, in a little van.
Yeah, so those vans are classic. They're called the UAZ, UAZ, and it's a Russian military issue vehicle, four wheel drive. It's also known as Bukhanka, which literally means loaf. And you'll probably, remember that the Volkswagens from the 60s and 70s also carried a similar title in they called them like the bread loaf as well. So it's got a similar kind of almost cartoon-like character nature to it. And they're the main vehicle that's used in crossing from side to side. So that's the vehicle that they use. And I love the character of it, and that's why it features in the book and the video.
Yeah, and it kind of, when you see it in the book, it stops you in your tracks. But what even attracted my attention further was when I got to page 31 of the book and I see this tree growing in the middle of the ice. And then I go to page 35 and I see another book, 45, or another tree, 45, another tree, 50, another tree. Yeah. How can anything grow in this particular landscape? Explain the trees first of all.
Okay, so I guess I came to Baikal looking for a project to do on ice. So once I got there, I wasn't sure what the project was going to be. I've been over the years developing my practice as an artist and looking for a common narrative that binds the images together. So I was looking for something. And when we crossed the Big Sea, because the Big Sea is very unstable because it's so deep, it's very unstable. So the ice can move away from each other, exposing fresh water below, or it can come together, like creating these jagged shards of ice known as hummocks, which block your way. So both, whether it separates or whether the ice comes together and creates hummocks, it blocks your way. So you have to find a way to get across the ice. And when I first saw these trees, the locals come along and they literally drill a hole in the ice and they put in the small pine tree. And then another 200 or 300 meters on, they'll do the same again, effectively creating road signs so that the travellers can cross, ensuring safe passage.
Yeah, so there's a touch of the Hansel and Gretel going on here, instead of breadcrumbs.
Get to one, find the next. Get to the next, find the next one.
And how far apart then would, the cities be? Are we talking about going from one side of the lake to the other? Is that what these trees do? They provide you with a pathway across?
Yeah, connecting the communities from one. Like, so one of the main roads crossing is almost in the centre there. It goes from Ulcan Island, a place called Uzuri on the east of Ulcan Island, and it crosses the Big Sea and it gets to a place called Barguzin in the Bay of Barguzin. And that would be another community. And so it basically connects the two communities.
I mean, you say to yourself, it's freezing cold. It's frozen ice that at depths, I suppose, times it would be thin enough, but we're talking about 2 meters a lot of the time. Wouldn't be, quite a thick ice that you can drive on, obviously, and that it's safe to drive on. What about the people who live there? How do they sustain a life in such what seems like an impossible climate situation?
Yeah, and becoming increasingly more impossible for them. I mean, for years they would have been loggers or working with trees, chopping trees, and fishermen. That would be the main work that was available in these communities. But recently, with the deforestation and the protection of forests, a lot of the forests have become protected. So they're losing their work around that. And then the other part of it, the fishermen, a lot of the fish have become illegal to fish now as well. So it's you see a lot of people moving away from these communities. And if you throw in the disconnect, as the winters get shorter, the connectivity from one side to the other and getting around becomes trickier. And so their winters are getting shorter and makes it harder to cross. So they don't all have boats, but they've all got a vehicle they can drive across. So in the big winters, they can just make their way across continuously.
And presumably the name of the exhibition and the name of the book here, Beeksens, is a reference to those trees that are literally, there's the one tree, find the next one, find the next one. They're beacons across this seemingly inhospitable landscape.
Exactly. Beacons, like you find one, and if you look for signs, you'll find your signs and then they'll help guide you across. Now, I like to see it as a metaphor for life, that we all need to find our own beacons to help guide us. And, if you're lost at any point and you find your way back, there's a sanctuary in that. And, there was one point we did lose the trees after sunset one evening and, you really started to feel, I was feeling very safe up until that point. And then once we lost the tree and we lost the road, like my fear increased so much. And then when we eventually found the tree again, it was like, oh my God, the waves of relief came across me. It was, and it kind of made sense to me that you lose your way in life or wherever it might be. And you find your way back. There's a beauty in that as well.
How long do the trees survive though? I mean, you're saying that
they plant them. Sorry, yeah. So they don't survive as such. They're like, it's like a little Christmas trees.
Yeah.
So they drill a hole, they put them into the ice, and they're just branches are cut off. So they there's no more surviving in it. They're not planting it down to the water below. They're just in ice. So they'll get them through the winter, and I guess then when the lake thaws again, the trees just fall in and they'll get washed ashore and become driftwood then.
All right, yeah. So it is literally just a man-made, it happens to be a tree, but it could be a metal post stuck into the ice. But that's not as romantic at all, is it?
Well, you know, it's interesting you should say that, because this year that I went, or sorry, it was last year now, it's 2020, I went out there and there was the odd tree that was left, but the locals were saying we're not allowed to use the trees anymore. So they had a lot of flagpoles. And if you notice, on the there's a picture at the back of the book that has a flagpole in it. And I have a little part in it there saying everything is in transition. And it's a little flagpole with like a plastic flag just flapping on it. And that's what they're starting to use now. And yes, you're right, it's not as romantic, but that's what's happening.
Yeah, and the dreaded word plastic is in the middle of all of that as well.
I know the trees would be much more organic to just be driftwood.
The other thing that I was wondering, you mentioned about how the deforestation and all of these items are having an effect on things. What about climate change itself? How is that affecting the lifestyle and the life of these people who obviously have settled there and are happy to live there?
Yeah, they are, but there's a lot of people, like the younger generations are moving to the cities now. I mean, that's what's happening essentially, because it's becoming harder and harder to sustain a living at the shores. Like now, there's tourism is on the increase. That's the flip side of it. So tourism's growing. So a lot of people are switching into tourism, like building hotels and restaurants and things like that. So that's also part of the transition.
Yeah. Again, building hotels, building them where? On the edges of, on the shores of the lake, yeah?
Yeah, in the little communities, but which are becoming bigger communities because of the tourism. I mean, they don't have the money for anything else. So the work isn't there in the other aspects, so they're now becoming the tourists.
Yeah, but I'm guessing the tourists will bring their own problems. I'm also thinking of climate change in terms of the melting of the ice. Has it become much more hazardous a task, even in the depths of winter, to drive across this lake?
Not in the depths of winter, unless you find a methane bubble. So the methane bubbles come up from the bottom and they create a thin layer of ice because these bubbles hit the surface and you have to watch out for them. But mostly it's not really an issue. That in the depths of winter, the ice is really thick, so it's safe.
Looking through the photographs then that are in the book, the colour that really strikes me, and it's the colour that you have in the design on the front of the book, it's a kind of an icy blue. Is blue the predominant colour that you're looking at when you're in and around this area?
Well, some of the pieces of ice have blue, but other there's lots of darkness. And then if it's snow, like the depth of the lake, when you're looking straight down it, it's very dark. And then you get the white line, the white cracks of the ice. But then, yeah, blues, blacks, whites would be the main colours that you'd be looking at. The exhibition shows them all. So, I mean, it actually it's on virtually starting from Wednesday. So, you know, people, if they wanted to, could log on to my Eventbrite and have a look, book a Zoom slot.
And do the natives then have numerous words for the various bits of ice, and the way we hear the Eskimos have so many words for snow? Would they have, they don't just talk about the ice, I'm guessing.
No, they have exactly. And as it melts into different types and the way it falls and breaks apart, they have, as you say, like the Inuits, they have many, many different names for it. And I guess that's important because it's relevant to their safety in terms of describing the ice in an accurate way.
Yeah. One final thing you might tell me about, which I thought was very interesting that you write about in the book as well, is the internal compass of the Buriats, who I presume are one of the names for the native people.
Yeah, I mean, they used to build their yurts with the doors facing south and the beds with their heads facing north, so that from early childhood, that everything they did was coming in and out of the doors. They knew where south was, they knew where north was, where they slept. So they developed this like built-in system of navigation. And I love that kind of idea. So I wanted to put that story into the book as well.
All right. Well, listen, it's a fascinating story, and 3 or 4 winters there, I'm sure, put the hairs in your chest. I also was amazed on some of the videos, by the way. It sounds like your mother now. You didn't seem to be wearing very many clothes, Dara. Put on a coat when you go out in that weather, please. That's Dara.
Did Do you see the Baikal makeup when your eyes freeze over and all the white?
Absolutely, ice yeah. Well, listen, Dara, thanks for speaking to us about that this evening. Dara Muldowney, and Beacons by Dara Muldowney is at the Copperhouse Gallery in Dublin. Online, as Dara told us, from Dara himself, runs until May at Dublin's Copperhouse Gallery. Access the exhibition via Dara's website, which is doulra.com, and the book Beacons available through that website as well. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Cullen was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock.